No, I understand that.
He's a good person. He won't need you.
To order, this is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is Monday, March 16th. We're continuing with a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, first of all, you will notice the bulb is burned out for the back, so you over here may have a little trouble seeing. And I'll also remind you, we're going to continue with medical assistance programs, and their presentation is on the posted on last Thursday. We may finish today, or we have time to have this carry over for part of tomorrow, if that's how it works out.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I am the state's Medicaid director, and I'm with the Oregon Health Authority. At the table with me, I also have, to my left.
Hi. For the record, I'm Kate Nass with the Department of Administrative Services and Financial Office.
For the record, I'm Lori Koiner, director of Health Analytics with the Oregon Health Authority.
So we left off from last Thursday on slide 11, in which we had just outlined some of the historical context that led us to work on health system transformation efforts. We spoke a little bit about the unsustainable healthcare cost increases, as well as a siloed healthcare delivery system. And then we also talked a little bit about the fact that another major thing in the wings at the time was focusing on the expansion of Medicaid. We spent a little time talking about access to care issues or questions about providers and how many providers there were. And I did get some additional information on both participating or the percent of participating dentists, and then as well as a little bit on whether we've seen a change at all in providers participating. And we have seen an increase across the board in physicians and nurse practitioners, et cetera, providing care. It was on average about 85% before the advent of the coordinated care organizations. And in the last year, we saw that jump up to averaging at 90%, with some areas substantially higher than that. For dental providers, it is almost the exact reverse as far as participating providers, in that on average, those that accept Medicaid, and granted this is from a different survey, but about between 18 to 20% report accepting new Medicaid, which is considerably lower than obviously than the physician. So we do have a concern when it comes to oral providers and dental providers. Now, what we do know is also that a lot of the dentists don't necessarily associate their contracts with the coordinated care organization or with a major provider like Moda Health or ODS. They don't necessarily type that up as, you know, as accepting Medicaid, but many do accept or contract with a coordinated care organization, even if they do not accept our fee-for-service rates. So it is something that that we continue to work on is in our efforts to help integrate and coordinate care. So, and actually, as that's a probably a good segue to go on to 12, slide 12, which is one of the things.
Chair?
Yes.
Can I just ask a clarifying question about that? So your fee-for-service rates are low, and so some dentists do not accept that correctly, I mean, directly, but the CCOs can pay whatever they want to the dentists that they contract with?
Yes, they can.
Right.
Yep. Sorry.
And so many are paying higher than the fee-for-service rate?
From what we understand, yes, they do.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so Judy, here we go. So 4 years ago, I'm out walking door to door because I love my people down in Albany. All right. And it was a nice sunny day. And I have this mom track me down, run me down. And she wants to talk to me while she works as a dental hygienist down there in Albany. But one of the things that she's extremely concerned about was she couldn't understand, and I've done homework since then, but the folks that are on, at that time, the Oregon Health Plan, there was no cap for the amount of dental work that they could receive. Now, I have a cap on my insurance. We all do. But the folks under the Oregon Health Plan at the time, and I don't know if that's still the case right now, have a cap for the dental work. I'm wondering if you can tell me where we're at on that.
Sure. Chair Nathanson, and you guys' names are reversed, so it's trying to trick me out.
That would be you. You are
so good.
Wow. Someone else would be calling you Rep. Boone.
Just call me Boone.
I almost called you Representative Boone, and I thought,
that's
no,
all right.
That's not right. Representative Olson.
It is Monday morning.
So we do have some limitations on the provision of dental services. It is a bit more challenging to make an actual like a dollar cap within the Medicaid program. So the types of service limitations, and we actually do have a more limited dental benefit for adults than we do for children. But we do have some service limitations on the provision of oral care. Some would argue that those are too restrictive as opposed to the other way around. We do not have costs caps. You know, for example, you know, you can only get like $500 worth of care because that's just not the way that the Medicaid program works. Instead, it's on the service limitations. You can get a cleaning every 6 months, for example, or caps on how many or upper limits and utilization limits on crowns and things like that. But we do have it's not a full adult dental benefit. There was some cutbacks. I believe it was 2 to 4 years ago that we did some service limitations on our oral benefit plan. And it's different for children than it is for adults. For children, we essentially cannot make restrictions, so it's the full complement of services all the time. But for adults is where you start to see the service limitations.
Children defined through what age? This
through,
particular issue.
Through 18. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Chair. On that, though, to clarify, even with children on some of the services, it might be that you can receive the, you know, a filling that's the silver type filling as opposed to a porcelain-colored filling. And so there are still some caps on. You can't necessarily get the upper end of what other people might have the option with their regular insurance plans. There's, you can get this or this or this, but not this range of services.
That's accurate, yes.
Thank you.
I have a cap on my plan as well. Okay. It pays for basic stuff and not fancy stuff.
Yep.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judy, just clarification too, you're just talking about dental here. I think you said something about MOTA doesn't accept something, and I missed the whole sentence.
Yes. Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone, what I was saying is when we analyze the provision of or what dentists are accepting what forms of insurance, it's actually very relatively low for how many accept Medicaid. You know, when they mark how many you know do I accept Medicaid, and we found that only 18-20% said, you know, checked yes, they accept Medicaid. What we know is that some of those dentists, however, when they have contracts with ODS or MOTA or a coordinated care organization, they don't associate those with Medicaid necessarily, and so the in other words, they will accept a contract with MOTA, or they will accept, or they do contract with a coordinated care organization that covers dental services. But in their answering of that dentist, when they answer that question, do they accept Medicaid, they don't associate that coordinated care organization as Medicaid. And so it's likely that the rate is higher as the number of dentists that do take the Oregon Health Plan, but it's through a coordinated care organization, or it's through a dental care organization, as opposed to which they don't associate as Medicaid necessarily.
So it's not like they don't have it directly with that insurance carrier.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone, they would have an agreement with that insurance carrier if that, for example, we contract with a coordinated care organization, and then that coordinated care organization in turn has contracts with a variety of dentists, and those. But those dentists may not associate that coordinated care organization with Medicaid necessarily, or the Oregon Health Plan necessarily. And so what we may experience then is that actually more of those dentists than what reported on the survey, more of those dentists may accept the Oregon Health Plan than what that figure of 18% to 20% represents. Is that helpful?
Sort of, and just one final to clarify it. So I know that PEB is trying to become more like, using more like the Oregon Health Plan, for that example. And is that idea that all the services that are for, if you're in the health plan, or if you're in the legislature, or you're a state employee at the prisons or whatever, that your health benefit system is the same? And so you would get the same services?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone, when we talk about the coordinated care model and how we're going to spread it to, beyond the Oregon Health Plan, we're going to have that be a model for PEB, a model for the legislature, a model for, commercial insurers. I believe that when we're speaking about the coordinated care model, we're talking about the fact that it's going to be community-based, that it's going to be modeled on integrated care, that it's going to be modeled on a sustainable, predictable rate of growth, but not necessarily the same sets of services that Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan would provide. So it would be likely integrated services, and it would most likely incorporate, mental health care and dental care and physical health care. But I think it's the model by which those services are provided, and that they're integrated, they're not siloed, that it's focused on the individual, the patient, and it's patient-centered care, it's the use of patient-centered primary care homes, those kinds of things, not necessarily the exact services, for example, the kinds of limitations that we may put on dental services for the Medicaid adult benefit wouldn't necessarily carry through to the other, like PEB or OWEB, et cetera. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that does. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. That's fine. So, I began to then, with the introduction then of the coordinated care model, which is what this next slide is talking about, the launch of health system transformation. And I know you've heard a lot about this already. Most of you have already heard about this, quite a bit about this. And so I'm not going to dive in a tremendous depth here, but I did want to cover at least the highlights. Is that we obviously began to focus in 2012 to focus on transformation of the health system to achieve better health, better care, and lower costs through coordinated care organizations that then emerged into the coordinated care model. And a little bit about the coordinated care organizations. They are a local network, community-based network of all types of healthcare providers working together then to deliver that care for the Oregon Health Plan members. And they're made up of a governing body that has primary care providers on it, has a mental health or substance abuse provider. It's made up of the 50% of those who take the financial risk, and then other major healthcare providers. They also need to have on their board, on the governing board, they also need to have at least one person from their community advisory council. And the community advisory councils are made up of community members, of consumers, of representatives from the county, which those coordinated care organizations serve. And their role is to do sort of the health assessment for their communities and then help set that strategic plan on how you're going to go about accomplishing that. And as I mentioned, their focus is on the integration of benefits and services, and it does cross the full range of physical health care, behavioral health care, and oral health care. We also focus on providing of not just those services that are traditional medical services. We also focus on the provision of what we call flexible services. Many of you have heard of the example of the air conditioner. There's also plenty of other examples of flexible services. And also the provision of those services from not necessarily physicians, for example, but rather community health workers, for example, on the provision of care within someone's home or out into the community. So it's a broad range of healthcare services that try to also get at the upstream effects of public health and address those in an integrated way. They're also accountable for performance metrics and outcomes. We'll hear a lot more about that, so I'm not going to dive into that, with a focus on primary care and prevention. And then finally, there's also the concept of aligning all those outcomes and all that provision of care and accountability of care with the financial and how it is that you pay for those healthcare services that helps promote primary care, helps promote prevention and healthy outcomes. So, and actually, here we are, slide 13. So we're going to start talking a bit about those performance metrics. One of the things that we did when we applied for our waiver to be able to provide to do the health system transformation efforts is that we had an agreement also that we would maintain and improve the quality of care, and then that we would also hold the coordinated care organizations accountable for the care, accountable for care. And so we have an annual assessment of statewide performance metrics, measures of 33 measures, and then we do get some financial penalties to the state if we don't accomplish those. And then the CCOs are accountable for 17 measures. There's largely an overlap between those two things, between so that the 17 measures are largely a subset of the statewide measures, but there are small differences. And then we'll hear a lot more about what those measures are, as well as how we make the payments, et cetera. In fact, I'm going to turn that over to Lori.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll walk a little bit through the metrics, and then I can answer questions also. So as Judy said, we have 33 measures that we monitor, track, and then we a couple times during our waiver demonstration, we need to roll those measures up and show that we're not degrading quality of care or access to care while we're trying to bend the cost curve. So that's the purpose of those. We did submit the first test of quality and access to CMS to the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services in February, and we have shown improvement, so I'd like to report that. And so we aren't at risk of any financial penalties because we've actually shown improvement across the state in quality of care when we
Madam
put
Chair,
a look at all of those
33
measures.
Can you be a little more specific as to what area of improvement that you've shown?
Yes, I can. And actually, let me see if it comes up here. So some of the areas of care that where we've shown improvement are reducing emergency department visits by the Oregon Health Plan members, decreases in hospital readmissions have we've decreased those, and so that's considered an improvement. We've increased members who are enrolled in patient-centered primary care homes, and that's one of the integrated primary care models that we've been focusing on. Now over 85% of all of the coordinated care organization members are enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home. We've also increased developmental screening for children by the age of 3, and so those are some examples. I will say that the measures that are incented, so what those 17 incentive measures have shown the much more improvement over time than the remaining 17 measures that are not don't have an incentive. So some of those are hospital readmissions, and some we have seen improvements, but not, they're more modest than the incentive measures.
So follow up, what's our benchmark when we get to the place on the prevention side of the reduction in the rate, for example, of diabetes or cardiovascular and some of those diseases and obesity, which we've got a high number in the state of Oregon. So when do we begin to capture those?
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, we do have a measure of blood sugar control for diabetes and blood pressure measurement for people with heart disease. Those two measures, for example, are extracted from medical records and not from our claim system, and so we've had to take some steps over time to capture that information. This year, when we make payments in June for the quality pool, it will be the first time that we're paying at least the kind of this challenge round for improvements in both the blood sugar testing for people with diabetes and the blood pressure measurements for people who have cardiovascular disease. We do not currently have measures that look at prevalence, so that means the proportion of people who have diabetes. We aren't looking to see whether that's reducing, and that's not one of the measures, for example.
But is there a plan to sometime in the future to get there? And I see a smile on the doc's face. If we're going to get to prevention, I guess what I'm saying.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Winters, the Metrics and Scoring Committee is the committee that selects measures. It was it's appointed by the director of the health authority. There's 9 members, and they examine them both. The current measure set, how the CCOs are doing, and then make changes to the 17 metrics over time. There is what we're calling an on-deck list of measures that they've reviewed. One of those, for example, is prevalence of tobacco use. Is slated for 2016, and they are starting to look at some of the more population-based measures. They're difficult to both measure them effectively and look at change over time, but they certainly have their focus on those measures much more so than in the beginning.
Some of the questions about the changes and measures.
Yep.
We just skipped ahead to slide 16, and we can speak a little bit about that if that's helpful, and then go back and cover the other ones.
Is there a slide that shows specifically the list of 17 measures?
We did not incorporate that specific slide. However, there's a complete report, et cetera, that we're
we're happy to share. It's information that's readily available and that we will...
Yes, it is readily available.
Yeah,
and
so we will definitely...
Excuse me. It would be terrific if someone who's working on a computer could get us over to the slide that shows the list of 17 metrics. I could find it here, but if you could find it, I think it would be interesting to find that.
Are we Wi-Fi?
Is it on that? Yeah,
it's if you have access.
A question.
No, there's no metric about this one.
Oh, it's not a list. Okay.
So we
don't have the list readily available out on the website, Lori was just saying. But we do have the list. We are actually looking at the list here. So what we'll do is we'll get that for you. We will bring that
The reason I'm
tomorrow.
Asking is some of the metrics, you can tell, have big dollar signs attached. For example, a hospital readmission is a very costly thing. Some of the measures are about costs. Some of the measures are a little bit more indirect about preventing costs, such as enrollment in a primary care medical home.
Mm-hmm.
I would be interested if you could show us, you could just put a little check mark or an asterisk, the measures that have that are more directly related to big expenses. Which are the things that are costing us a bunch of money, and which are the things that are really more preventive? And I'd like to see how that lines up with where the incentives are. Are the incentives on the preventive side or on the cost avoidance side? Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of quick things. First of all, I think you're making a really interesting point, and I point out that it's interesting to think about how do we balance the things that save us money in the short term versus things that save us money and improve health in the long term, right? And they're both important because obviously we have to save money in the short term to allow us to keep the system sustainable. And there are real benefits. Virtually everything we do that will save us money is actually good, really good patient care, as it should be. We shouldn't be doing things just to save money if they aren't good patient care. But these preventive things, like looking at obesity measures and the prevalence of diabetes in the population, are important. I would point out to the committee, and Ms. Coyner, please correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the challenges we face is that people, although there is a certain percentage of the population that gets on to the Oregon Health Plan and stays on the Oregon Health Plan, there's also a percentage that goes on for a year and then gets off, and then they're in a different system. So we don't have a way to track because they get a regular job and they get commercial insurance, or they become self-employed and then they qualify because they're earning enough money they qualify for commercial insurance. So it's going to be tough, and I would just point out to the committee, and Ms. Coyner, please again correct me if I'm wrong, it's going to be tough to some extent to track the things such as reducing prevalence of obesity, although the CCOs are charged with looking at community problems and doing community health assessments and picking one topic. And some pick tobacco use and some pick obesity management prevention. So I just think the committee needs to bear that in mind, that the CCOs are doing some really important work, but they only control, I mean, it's a significant percentage. A quarter of Oregon's population is in a CCO, but they won't necessarily stay in a CCO. And until, as I hope, pretty much most Oregonians are in something like a CCO and we're using identical metrics to cover all insurance plans, it's going to be tough to track and tough to know whether we're making a difference. And if I could, Madam Chair, really quickly, the question I was originally going to ask before you brought up this really excellent point was to Ms. Coyner. You said that the sense was that the performance on the 17 incented measures had been much better than on the 17 non-incented measures. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, you're going to retire a couple of the measures, some of which are good to, you know, I understand why you're retired. Elective delivery before 39 weeks, thank goodness, has largely gone away in the state. And I think most hospitals and health systems are pretty clear about that one, so we don't need that one anymore. But other ones, as we change over time, are we still going to be tracking them to make sure that we don't have backsliding, and how are we thinking about the other 17 measures, which are also really important ones, or we wouldn't be including them?
Madam Chair, and Senator Stein,
Ms. Kleiner, I apologize.
If you could show the slide of what we retired and not, I can answer that question. And then also I'd like to address Representative Nathanson's questions about cost. So we did retire early elective delivery. That we, being Metrics and Scoring Committee, chose to retire it. And for example, in 2012, the percentage of babies that were born with an elective delivery was approximately 13% in the state, and it's now down below 3%. And so that is largely due to the hospitals putting what's called a hard stop, so that those types of deliveries are no longer happening in most hospitals. So the committee decided that there isn't room for more improvement. They did keep the measure 1 year to make sure that it wasn't going to go away, but they also decided that there, the energies of the CCOs would be better focused on something where they can start to continue to show improvement. However, to your point, that measure is still part of our 33 measures that we have to report to the federal government, and so we will be always, or we'll be calculating and monitoring that measure across time and reporting it quarterly or annually, actually, for this case, to the CMS, and so that when we can see if there are changes that go in the wrong direction, and then that's the type of data that Metrics and Scoring Committee monitors. So is that helpful?
That's very helpful. Thank you.
And then in terms of the cost, that's a really interesting question, Madam Chair. The measures fall under a number of different categories. The focus of the original measurement set was on the triple aim, so that's better health, better care, and lower costs. And so the measures cover the gamut. So some of the better health measures, and I think this points to Senator Steiner Hayward's comments about what we call sometimes upstream care. So, for example, screening for depression and follow-up may help identify members who have problems with depression. They can get treated so that they don't end up costing the system more later because their depression was not taken care of. Some of the cost measures that we are looking at, or another one is patient-centered primary care homes. The idea is if patients can be established or members can be established in an integrated care system, they can have better treatment early on, and that will prevent things like hospital admissions. So part of our 33 measure set, we have four prevent hospital admissions measures for conditions where people should not be in the hospital if they get good primary care, and those we've seen pretty dramatic increases. And what we think is that building this integrated model then helps prevent some of the more costly things later on.
Yes, thank you. Senator Winters.
Madam Chair, and I need to go back to this because I haven't heard it. And in our conversation when we first began the discussion and rolling this out, we talked about the 20% that consumes 80% of the cost. And that 20%, if I can remember the discussion, was those diseases that I talked about early on, and that we would begin to focus on some of those, like diabetes, cardiovascular, and some of those particular diseases, which do consume an enormous amount of cost. And so whether it's through the, and if I can recall some of the discussion right, even the navigators, that would be a part of some of the follow-up and the work, were to actually, the reason for those is to actually change some behaviors, you know, among the patient. And maybe I missed and didn't hear all the conversation. If it is, I'm going to get me two new ears. But if I recall, in bending this cost curve, that was also a component of this. And so my question is, how do you track that? If we actually are going to focus on that 20% and that high utilization rate. And I understand the ER piece and our work on that and that cost curve.
Chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, thank you for that that question. And I think it's a very interesting policy sort of conversation. And I think with the metrics, we do indeed, we do, as Lori pointed out, Ms. Coyne pointed out, we do have some metrics that focus on that, on the where the where those costs are. So you are accurate there in the, they're in the costs for diabetes, they're in the costs for related diseases that emerge because of tobacco or because of obesity, et cetera. And I think one of the interesting dynamics that's been going on, and I think the Metrics and Scoring Committee has been doing an admirable job in balancing this, is balancing between those preventive measures and those acute ones that, you know, are affecting the costs right now, between developing a measure for every single population versus targeting, okay, these large populations, for example, some that focus on children, some that focus on pregnant women, some that focus on older adults, and then also trying to focus on more the few changing the way that care is delivered, for example, focusing on the patient-centered primary care homes versus more of an outcome measure, which is are some of the other measures. And I think the other category of metrics that we've been focusing on that we haven't brought up yet is around mental health and substance abuse, which is also a higher prevalence within the Medicaid population, or at least has traditionally been higher prevalence. And it's also a major part of our model of care, is trying to integrate care across different systems, delivery systems of care. So it's not just for physical health care metrics, but it's also looking at those metrics which cross over. So it's follow up after mental illness, or follow up after hospitalization for mental illness. I'll get that measure right, as well as substance abuse screening. So it's trying to find that blend of focusing on the major areas of the costs, which are immediate and today, as well as with trying to go more upstream and focus on changing, one, the delivery of care, as well as looking at the outcomes of care. So and it's hard to do that with this number, because you also don't want to have too many measures, because then you start to lose the focus. But if you have too few, then you don't have that broad depth. So it's trying to find that, you know, that Goldilocks number and topics, et cetera, of just the right number, covering just the right topic areas, et cetera, where there's actually room for improvement, you can measure it, et cetera. So that's been the goal, and I think they've been doing the Metrics and Scoring Committee has been doing an admirable job.
If CMS can identify what our obesity rate is in Oregon, what our diabetes rate in Oregon, what our cardiovascular issues are, can't we start at that point and see how it's dropped or diminished?
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, we have another set of metrics that we didn't include in this, what we call the core performance measures, and they are listed in our waiver, and we need to report them. And they push, they're a little bit more population focused. So for example, we do have prevalence of tobacco use. Another measure there is the prevalence of obesity that we need to report at the CCO level. I don't think they're listed on the set that you have. There's effective contraceptive use, which now is an incentive measure, but that was one of the core performance measures. And so we do have some measures that we're monitoring and tracking that we don't necessarily have to, you know, have incentives tied to, but that we have to report and assess, and then we did include those this in January in our mid year performance report, and so they are available and they're publicly reported in that report,
so we can share those with you.
Thank you. We've really taken you off script for a little while, but as always, the committee is very interested in what you're presenting. So do you want to go back to, I think we left off at 13. We probably covered it mostly.
The 13. I think we can move to slide 14.
So this slide describes how the incentive dollars are paid to CCOs. The very first year that we made the payment was for performance that occurred in 2013. We made the payment to the CCO, each of the CCOs, in June 30th of 2014. And at that time, it was 2% of their expenditures were held in this pool, and then they're paid out based on how they perform on the 17 measures. For 2014 experience, we will be making those payments again in June, where we will be pulling the data. It takes a little while to make sure you get all the claims and information in, and so we will pull the data in April and allow the CCOs time to review their data. Though we do provide the coordinated care organizations their information on their measures, all the 33, on a monthly basis, so they see this across the year. To earn their full quality pool payment, they need to either meet the benchmark or their own improvement target on at least 12 of the 17 measures and have at least 60% of their measures enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home.
How many met that second target, 60%, enrolled in primary care?
Madam Chair, all about one in 2013. I currently, as the data, the last I looked, which is I think the end of 2014, all of them surpassed that.
Thank you.
So we distribute funds. If they meet all of these requirements, they are paid their full amount. Otherwise, they're paid something less. And that remaining money goes into what we call a challenge pool. That's because the quality pool dollars, all of those are distributed every year. So the leftover money, as it were, is paid in what's called a challenge pool. The four measures on this slide, depression screening and follow-up, diabetes, that's blood sugar control, screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment is a screening for alcohol and drug misuse, and then the patient-centered primary care home enrollment. We look to see which CCOs performed either, again, met their improvement target or surpassed the benchmark, and then they're paid on these four measures. Why are these measures in the challenge pool? The metrics and scoring committee selects measures that they think are most transformative, meaning that are moving the healthcare system along and challenging for the coordinated care organizations. For 2015, they took out the patient-centered primary care home enrollment. It's still an incentive measure. It's just not a challenge measure because the CCOs are doing so well on it. But and they replaced that with developmental screening. And part of the thinking there was that it dovetails with the early learning focus from the early learning hubs, and the second thing was they wanted to have a measure that was focused on children in the challenge pool.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to take the liberty of making a comment. Several of you referred to what the long-term outcomes could be. I would argue that changing to this developmental screening measure is one of the most important things we can do to meet our 40-40-20 goals, to keep people out of the criminal justice system, and to ensure long-term health, because identifying developmental challenges very early and getting kids the support that they need dramatically increases the likelihood of success in school and long-term being a long-term productive, healthy member of our society. So I'm very, very pleased to hear that this has been added as a measure, and I think for long-term well-being, it's one of the best things we can do.
So when I'm looking at the measure sets, and thank you very much for making copies for us to have up here at the desk, I see that developmental screening remains in the measure set on the printed list. It says developmental screening in the first 36 months of life. So it has been there. It's just been added to the challenge grant because, as you're saying, you elevated it in importance and to bring new focus to it. So we've actually been working on this for a while. There's just additional money and an additional incentive to work on it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. We can move to the next slide. So this is just a high-level summary on how the coordinated care organizations performed in 2013. 11 of the 15, at that time there were 15 coordinated care organizations, now there are 16. But 11 of the 15 earned 100% of their quality pool, and of the four who did not earn 100% of their quality pool, one earned 70% and three earned 80%. And we showed statewide improvement on all of the four of the it says 14 incentive measures. That is because there are three that we're capturing through an electronic medical record, and they were paid in 2014 for submitting a plan for how they are going to capture the data and a 10% sample of data. For 2014, they've had to update their transformation plan and then submit 50% or information from electronic medical records for 50% of their members. We've seen statewide improvement overall on nine of the 17 other metrics of the 33 set, and two measures there was not statewide improvement in 2013. Those are chlamydia screening and cervical cancer screening. Those, as a staff, we've been looking carefully at those two measurements, and part of the reason that we believe the cervical cancer screening measure has not increased is because of changes in guidelines number one, now the recommended time to have your first cervical cancer screen isn't until age 21, so it's older, and then the frequency of them is less. In 2014, we did release a mid-year progress report that was released in January. It's available on the website, and we can provide that link. And we are seeing continued progress in many of the measures, which makes me happy, so that we don't think it's just a one-time, you know, anomaly, but we're really seeing progress over time, particularly in emergency department utilization and other harder measures like the screening for alcohol and drug misuse. That's, as a state, we started with almost no providers doing that screening, and so we're seeing dramatic increases, though it's still modest. The number of people who are being screened is going up in large percentages.
Could you please tell me, give an example of what that means, that we're now doing screening? I think I get it, you know, intellectually, but does that mean that almost no providers were either asking questions or looking for certain clues and following up on them, and now they're asking questions or noting if something appears to be a symptom or related to alcohol or drug misuse? What does it mean that we're doing screening that we weren't doing screening before?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. So there were likely many providers who were, you know, asking questions and doing, you know, following up. What we implemented with what's called ESPERT, it stands for screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. So what it's a more comprehensive method for not only identifying people who may have risky drinking or drug use, but then also having someone on staff. It can be a physician, it can be another ancillary staff member that is trained in giving a what's called a brief intervention. And in that brief intervention, they may talk to somebody who is not maybe not experiencing problems in their life due to their drinking, but maybe are heavy drinkers, and so they do motivational interviewing and kind of talk to them about their drinking, and then if they do have severe issues, refer them to treatment. So it's a stepwise process that is more formalized than what had been in the past. And for example, the screening tools, you know, there's certain evidence-based screening tools that we also recommend the coordinated care organizations use. So it's more identifying very early on, before someone has a problem that's affecting their life severely.
Thank you. That's helpful. Screening, in the types of reports I read, and I'm not a physician like we have professionals on the committee,
But screening sometimes means literally a test of some sort. Like vision screening, there are tests using instruments. Hearing screening. For other things, screening may involve a blood test, maybe. But in this case, we're talking about it's not a specific testing device or testing mechanism. It happens more through the power of observation and follow-up. Is that right?
If I may, if we're talking about ESPRT, right, then it's actually there is a standardized instrument that we use. Depending on the situation, we use certain, validated screening questions that help us identify whether somebody's at risk for depression or for drug or alcohol misuse. And if they're screened positive on those, then they'll get a more detailed set of validated questions. So you're absolutely right, Madam Chair, there is actually a validated instrument that we use for this as well.
Thank you.
Can I ask just I'm listening to the screening and don't get me wrong, because I think it's a value, but I'm trying to leap from the screening to the overutilization of ER. I guess that's where my head is. And what are the top 10 reasons that people visit ER? Since that's one of our one of our really top goals is to reduce that utilization. And I happen to live in the county that has the highest ER utilization rate in the state.
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, I don't have the top reasons for emergency department visits at my fingertips, so we can provide that for you.
I guess I'm trying to get the correlation. If we're going to drive down, if our goal, one of our goals is to drive down the utilization in ERs, and which is what is one of the drivers in our incentive plan, then I think we need to know what the top 10 reasons are for that. I guess for me, and I'm looking at my my community, and one is because they serve a wide area, you know, because it's the highest utilization from California clear up to Canada.
Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, we will get the exact details on what the top 10 were, but when we first initiated our work on health system transformation, we knew that one of the main reasons that has been leading to not just emergency room use, but also high utilization of all kinds of services, as well as the population itself, has been vastly sort of underserved, is around both a mental illness as well as with a substance abuse. It's a frequent co-occurring disorder with lots of other things. It's one of the reasons that we did focus on both of those things at the same time, that we're not focused on just emergency room use, but also some of the underlying reasons as to why people were using the emergency room, which has to do with mental health, mental illness reasons, or substance abuse, or they were coming into the emergency room, being treated for something else, but they had a substance abuse disorder. It's one of the drivers of overall healthcare costs, and so those two things actually are linked together between both the ER use as well as substance abuse, which is one of the reasons that we focused on the prevention tool. And I did want to note, it's skipping ahead a little bit, is on our hospital transformation performance pool, one of the reasons that we chose one of the hospital CCO coordinated measures is not just the sharing of the emergency department information, but we know with the coordinated care organizations and the hospitals, but also focusing in on hospitalization for mental illness. And so it's a measure for the hospitals as well, not just the coordinated care organizations. And then the use of the ESPRT tool in the emergency room as well, because that's one of the key areas where you find those two things
together.
I'm
going to look back and ask that question of my hospital and see if they're getting an overabundance of individuals in mental health and substance abuse.
So we're actually hopeful that that has changed over time due to our efforts. And we're hoping that, those figures will start to go down for those particular things. Can we skip ahead to
Representative
16?
Boone.
Yes, thank you. I didn't see anywhere in this three pages of health authority measures anything about clinical breast exams. And I wondered how, you know, a few years ago we did implement that as a mandate for insurance services. And I'm just wondering if, you know, I know as far as I'm concerned, it's not always the same, but I've been going to the same practitioner for a long time, and so she sort of knows me and all that. But how do, are women getting these 10-minute plus clinical breast exams that are more thorough than just the quick, have you felt anything lately, that kind of thing? And I just don't see it on the performance measures, and I haven't heard much about it. And then in that vein, I heard a very disturbing article on NPR a couple weeks ago about a doctor claiming that we do too many exams, we do too many preventive things, we shouldn't go to the doctor at all unless there is a problem, things like that. And I'm just wondering if you're hearing about that and how that's folding into all this.
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, we do not have any, you're correct, there is not a breast cancer screening measure in the measure set. I think at the time, part of the reason is that if you think about what the distribution or representation of members who were on the Oregon Health Plan at the time that these measures were selected, it was primarily younger women of childbearing age and children. And so the Metrics and Scoring Committee at that time did not focus as much on older women because there were many fewer who are covered on the Oregon Health Plan. We have seen with the change in enrollment with the Affordable Care Act that there are more, the age distribution has changed. There's more adults on the Oregon Health Plan now, but at this time there is not any measure around breast cancer screening.
I'll follow up. It's the law that we have to offer this, and I'm wondering why it's not on.
It's a covered service. So we do provide those services, and we certainly can take a look and provide the measure for that, even if it's not on the incentive, you know, metrics. What Lori is speaking to is what the Metrics and Scoring Committee, the measure set that they chose to take a look at, and you know why it was that they focused on those particular ones. But we certainly do. Providing mammograms and breast cancer screening is a covered benefit under the Oregon Health Plan, and it is promoted, et cetera. So women's health in general is definitely covered.
Yeah.
Covered services and benefits.
I'll follow up on that because it's like I think Oregon is the second highest in the nation for breast cancer, and it's not all older women. A lot of younger women are, and they're not going in. They're not being encouraged to go in and get checked until they're 40. And by then, it can be too late.
If I may, Representative Boone, having spent a lot of my other professional career focusing on early detection of breast cancer, because it's one of the things I do. I actually used to run a major program in the United Cancer Institute, OHSU, devoted to this. We face a huge challenge with this issue because there is no evidence-based screening for women under 40. There is no way to screen women under 40 that has been proven to reduce morbidity and mortality from breast cancer. And I know that's tough to believe, but mammograms really in women under 50 are not a useful tool. They have as many false positives as they have true positives, leading to a lot of unnecessary testing. They have a lot of false negatives. So 60% of women under 50 who have breast cancer have a normal quote-unquote mammogram, because women under 50 have dense breasts, and it makes it denser breasts, and it makes it harder to find a breast cancer early. We face huge challenges in this arena, and I will say one really important thing, which is that although Oregon does have among the top two or three, depending which year it is, rates of breast cancer in the country, we've done a really good job overall of reducing our rate of late diagnosis, because even though we don't have a good way to screen younger women, we do have a really good way of, we've been doing a really good job of educating women that if they find something that doesn't seem normal to them, they notice something that doesn't seem normal, they need to seek care right away. So I completely appreciate your concern, but, and we do need to be educating women that women, younger women, can and do get breast cancer. That's absolutely important, but we don't have a good way to screen for it. And there is no evidence-based way to screen. And the recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force now is that routine mammography only starts at age 50, because under 50, it's such a complicated, imprecise, inaccurate tool. It's a conversation to have with women under 50, but it's not actually recommended to start routinely, and then only every 2 years, starting at age 50. So I appreciate where you're coming from, because it's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about professionally. I don't want to take up too much time. I'm happy to talk with you more offline, but it's a very complicated problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Let's continue.
Thank you. We're going to move ahead to slide 17, because we already talked about slide 16, if that's all right. During the last legislative session, 13-15, we launched into a new performance program that focuses on hospitals. It's called the Hospital Transformation Performance Program. In general, it focuses on quality health metrics that show how well hospitals are advancing health system transformation and how well they're doing to help reduce costs and improve patient safety. There was, in part of the statute, there was also a designation of a outcome and quality measurement committee that was focused for the hospitals. That again was also appointed by the OHA director, and then we spent. It took us about a year to get agreement with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but we did finally accomplish agreement with them to operate this program. So the requirements of the program were, and it was just a two-year program at the time. It was focused on just year one, which was a baseline year, so it was reporting of those measures, and then we would work on the benchmarks, et cetera. And then year two would be focused then on the performance of, you know, if they're showing improvement during that time period. In order to do subsequent years, we would need a new agreement with CMS, and we would also need legislative approval, and we'll talk a bit more about that at a later point in this presentation.
Next slide.
Yeah. So the next slide, which is slide 18, focuses on the measures themselves. There were six primary measures that are captured, and they are, as I think we mentioned before, they're captured in two primary areas. One are very hospital specific, and the other, there's two that are focused on the CCO hospital coordination focused. So there's six domains with 11 measures for the first 2 years of this particular program. The particular areas and the domains, they focus and they have a lot of alignment with the Medicare program, so that there can be some sort of everybody moving forward and pushing forward in the same direction, and that we share some of those as well. And they focus on readmissions, medication safety, the patient experience, which is similar to what the CCOs also measure, is patient experience, and then hospital-associated infections, which is a patient safety measure. The hospital CCO coordination.
Could you please say measures. More about medication safety, what that means?
Sure. There are three specific measures in there, and I am going to ask Lori to speak to those.
Madam Chair, there are three measures. They're focused on very specific medications. One's called hypoglycemia in patients receiving insulin, excessive anticoagulation with warfarin, and adverse drug events due to opioids. Part of the reason that those three were selected is there was a program that was ongoing within our state where hospitals were working together to improve these measures, and the idea, and that they'd seen progress, and so the idea was to expand that movement, I would say, across all of the hospitals in the state to focus on some of these patient or medication safety measures. But more broadly, I guess, around medication, the patient experience measure is focused on two questions. So there's something called HCAHPS, which is a standardized tool that's given to patients after they've been in the hospital that asks about their experience. And they selected two measures. One is whether the doctor or someone at the hospital adequately explained their medications to them. And the other is whether they received, someone gave them discharge instructions and they told them what to do once they left the hospital. And so the medication safety, I think, is kind of a dual focus in that we have these specific questions around in that medication safety domain, but in the patient experience domain, it was also around whether someone's gone through their medications with them, and we get that as a report back from patients. Is that helpful?
Yes, I personally have concerns about what happens when patients are discharged. It's a time of stress. You may be feeling pretty unwell still. You may be taking certain kinds of medication, so you're not thinking as clearly as you normally do. You may not remember what you were told. And I remain very concerned that time spent with all that careful explanation at the hospital may not be 100% useful, that it may be the follow-up a half a day later or a day later to find out, did they actually absorb the instructions, and are they following them?
Chair Nathan, that is a very good point, and that's actually a major concern and focus of across the board in many different payer types, as well as with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. There's a very large focus on it's not just the discharge planning for that particular reason, but it's also trying to pay attention to the other ancillary, you know, impacts. So, for example, that's one of the reasons that we have the focus on the all-cause readmissions for, you know, to get readmitted, because part of that so-called discharge planning is if you give all those instructions, but then, you know, the person isn't going to remember, et cetera. So it's focusing on, well, what are you going to do to make sure that those people are still well and taken care of, and know how to take care of themselves and know what medications to take after that. So it's the focus on the readmissions. We actually have a couple of readmission measures. We have what's called the all-cause readmissions, which is the same as the Medicare measure. And then we also have one that's similar to the CCO measure, which is the follow-up after hospitalization from mental illness. And again, it's for the same reason. It's to make sure that that there is an appropriate sort of handoff, and also that the appropriate care happens for that person no matter which part of the healthcare delivery system they're in.
Thank you.
I also was somewhat remiss in noting that that this particular program is for the largest hospitals in the state, because it's also associated with funding using the hospital assessment, and that the hospital assessment is paid by the largest hospitals, and so that's why those two things are associated with each other. The slide 19 on the funding and payment allocation, it's modeled very similarly onto how we do the coordinated care organization payments. And so it's awarded based on their performance on their measures. At first year is based on the reporting, and the second year is based on their performance of the measures. The first payments will be made at the end of this month, actually in 2015 here, and it will be up to $150 million. and they will also get the advantages of also of a challenge pool, although I can't speak to what the metrics are in the challenge pool, because I don't remember.
Actually, there's no challenge pool for the hospital metrics, okay. But all of the information, I mean, all of the dollars are distributed. The committee chose a slightly different methodology, which I can bring if you're interested, but they are paid on a measure-by-measure basis, and then it's kind of distributed completely on a measure-by-measure basis to the hospitals.
And next year's measures will be, performance will be paid on the difference in their performance between this year and the next year. So now we can move along to major program changes. This is me. So this is, we've undergone, as I think we've covered quite frequently here, is undergone some pretty dramatic program changes over the past 2 years. And one of the most dramatic was our Medicaid expansion, which went live in January of 2014. We expanded eligibility, and we have more than 380,000 adults now with incomes at 133% of the federal poverty level or below. So it's quite substantial. With the expansion, there was a 100%, with this particular population group, there's a 100% federal match for the first 2 years. So it's through, so calendar year is 2014, calendar year 2015, and then through calendar year 2016, so it's 3 years. And then there's sort of a step down in federal funding for ACA adults, and that's included on the slide here, so that in calendar year 2017, in other words, the last 6 months of this particular biennium, the federal match for this particular population will drop from 100% to 95%, which is still substantially higher than our standard Medicaid rate, which is about 62%. In calendar year 2018, it's at 94%. Calendar year 2019 is 93%. And then calendar year 2020, it begins at 90%, and all subsequent years would be at 90%. And so in January of 2014, we began to receive 100% federal match for the population that used to be called the OHP standard. I covered that last Thursday. As a reminder, that was our expansion population that was adults who didn't qualify for traditional Medicaid that went up to 100% of the federal poverty level. And by the CMS rules, we were able to have them be determined as newly eligible and to qualify for that 100% match. So that was quite a substantial savings for us as well. So other major program changes that are occurring is with our eligibility system that was being used, that instead of using that eligibility system, that was in effect, well, actually, it's currently in effect right now. Instead, we will be moving to adopt a successfully implemented system elsewhere. And I realize I used the acronym of MAGI here, and I haven't explained it. So that stands for Modified Adjusted Gross Income. It's the new methodology in which how Medicaid uses, it's the methodology that Medicaid uses to determine the means test to determine where they are in the federal poverty level or their income. So we will be adopting a system that was implemented in Kentucky. It will be an online system portal for people to apply for Medicaid, specifically the means tested portion of Medicaid. There will also be a worker portal that will be more in-depth that our caseworkers and eligibility workers and call center people can use to do their eligibility work and to do their what we would call the case maintenance work. If everything goes well and we're able to verify income and verify all their information. If you apply online, you will be able to get an immediate real-time determination of whether you're eligible or not. And then it will be a more automated redetermination and renewal process when people are come up for their annual renewal, for example. They will be able to do that online and go through that process. It will take us some time to get all the way there, and it by no means will be solve sort of all problems, because of course we know better than to say that or to expect for nirvana. However, it will be substantially better than the system that we have today, which is not very automated and very challenging to use. So we will continue this past year, or this past open enrollment in November of 2014. We switched to hooking up with the federally facilitated marketplace, or the healthcare.gov. And so if someone is not eligible for Medicaid, then we will automatically transfer that their information to the, shorthand is called the FFM, so to the FFM. And then in reverse, if someone were to apply at the federal marketplace and it looks like they may be Medicaid eligible, then the FFM will automatically transfer that information back to us through Securely. So that's what we're working on right now with adopting the this particular system. And so we'll move along to other sorts of major budget drivers that occur within our program area. I believe that you also heard about this from Ms. Saxton when she was here, our director of the Oregon Health Authority. She talked a little bit about how we need to maintain an expenditure growth. So as part of our agreement with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as part of our waiver, we agreed that we would maintain our costs to be no more than 3.4% growth every year, which is substantially lower than what our trend growth rates had been. But it's called a 2% test. In other words, it's 2 percentage points lower than what the annual trend rate was at the time which we were negotiating our waiver. So the baseline was calculated on calendar year 2011. The first year we had to reduce it from 5.4 to 4.4, and then we work on now it's a 3.4, and that's what we need to sustain. If we don't sustain it, then we do get a financial hit, which is related to this next major budget driver, and that's the shorthand acronym that we use is DSHPE, and it stands for Designated State Health Programs. So when we negotiated our waiver with the federal government, we said we got agreement that they would provide federal match for things that they would not ordinarily match, but they are for healthcare programs or services that are Medicaid-like, or for Medicaid population and for which we had not gotten Medicaid match for it before. Between the how the program works, we were able to obtain $1.9 billion over 5 years of the waiver, and in the 15-17 governor's budget, we have $376 million of total funds. So it includes both the federal match as well as the state funds that we are able to use within this within the DSPRI program. It's quite substantial. We do need to meet those two tests. We have to meet that growth test. We can't grow faster than that 3.4% annually. And we also need to maintain and improve our quality and access measures, which we spoke about at length earlier today. That's those 33 measures that we were talking about. So both of those things must be met. If we don't meet it, then the DSPRI itself is reduced by $68 million, and that translates into a total fund figure of $188 million.
I think this is a good place to stop, because when I look at what's on the next slide, given what you may talk about and what the questions may be, it could take a little while to go through it. We have completed an awful lot for today. I have something I'd like to go back to just as food for thought for a subsequent conversation. I thought you did a great job very early on at the beginning of your presentation today talking about explaining why the measures for dentists accepting patients, it's the Medicaid rate, and how the numbers may not be, they're not accurate in one sense because they are treating some of the patients who would be included under that group, it's through another way. The explanation was terrific, but I left myself wondering, is it necessary or important to keep dental care or dentists being explained and measured in a different way than medical providers? And is there a way to get at a more normalized comparison?
Chair Nathanson, it is something that we can certainly take a look at. We get the measures from two different sources. There's a healthcare provider survey that we do, and I can't remember if we're still in partnership. Perhaps Lori knows if we're still in partnership with the provider community. But it is something that we can take a look at. We get the dental provider information, and we just started getting it in the last 2 years, I believe, through it, because it was added to a question for when dentists need to come up for licensure, and they need to come up every 2 years, they need to get relicensed. And so it was a question that was added to that. But I don't know if there's another method. Perhaps Lori would know on the how we measure the other providers and their healthcare.
We have a my office fields a physician workforce survey. It does not include dentists, but and it's in coordination with the Oregon Medical Association. And I believe we should have results from that soon. It was just fielded, but we haven't expanded that to the dental community. So I could look into it. But
I'd like us to be able to think about it a bit later in the session. Not, I don't expect any suggestions or other deeper dive comments today. But the more we try to integrate physical health, which is medical and dental, with behavioral health, and we're trying to make sure that from the patient's point of view, we have a very comprehensive and holistic way of helping someone achieve health or maintain health, I think it complicates things. And different providers are either held to different standards, or you think you're trying to hold them to the same standards, but you can't measure apples and apples. I remember hearing that one of the common occurrences at the emergency department in my area is people coming to have someone take care of dental pain. And there's really nothing they can do other than provide them with something to relieve the pain. Maybe there's someone there to pull a tooth, but they haven't had care. And there was a big concern. This is a couple of years ago. The situation may be a lot better now. But there's obviously such an integration of needing to look at care across all different types of what can go wrong with the human body.
Madam Chair, I do want to mention that there was a dental metrics subcommittee that met last year a number of times and provided guidance and recommendations to metrics and scoring committee on dental metrics for much for the reason that you just mentioned. And so there was one dental measure that was added, and that's dental sealants for children. But there was a lot of discussion about and measuring adults who've had one oral health visit during the last year, and we will be reporting that. It's not an incentive measure, and it may be another way to take a look at whether adults are accessing services with dentists and not using the emergency department or going without care until it gets to be a crisis. And so the metrics and scoring committee has added some features once the coordinated care organizations were responsible for dental care.
Great. I'm really glad of that. So then being able to see how many dentists are participating in the way that we can see how many physicians mm-hmm. are participating, that would be useful. Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee? We're adjourned for today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.